This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Roughly a fifth of all fish eaten globally are caught using nets towed along the bottom of the ocean. There's long been concern that this method, known as trawling, destroys or severely damages the ecosystems where it's used. Now, a new meta-analysis of the science available on this topic finds that not all trawls are equal and that some do significantly less damage than others. Joining me now via Skype to talk about what this means for New England's fisheries and ocean ecosystems is Steve Ayers. He's a research scientist at Gulf of Maine Research Institute, where he specializes in fishing gear design and innovation. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Heather. Thanks very much. It's good to be here.
This meta-analysis, roughly how many individual studies was it that they were drawing on and looking at for this new analysis?
I think it was about 70 studies, they said, in total that they used. And, they reviewed studies from all around the globe and have produced what appears to be a really important paper on just what the true impacts of trawling are.
The 70 studies, does that sound like a lot to you or a few? Would you like to see more studies going into an analysis like this?
I think that's a great number of studies. I mean, the authors are some of the most foremost fishery scientists on the planet. They come from all around the globe, and it looks to me like they've done a very thorough study and a very good job. And that's to be expected from these individuals who have such a great profile and a long history of doing this sort of work.
Trawls can be classified into four different types, and this analysis actually looked at the impacts of those four individual types, not trawling as a whole. Otter trawls are the type that's most commonly used here in New England, correct?
Yes, that's correct. So the term they used of otter trawl, it refers to what you see here on the coast of New England, where the boats are towing a net. Between the net and the boat, there are long wires that run over the seabed, and then attached to those wires are what's called otter boards. The official term is otter boards, and most fishermen here refer to them as boards or doors. And these are large steel devices which are used to put the trawl down on the seabed, and they help spread the trawl open horizontally.
And how is that otter trawl different from these three other kinds of trawls that were looked at in this new study?
Well, the other trawls they spoke of was, in addition to otter trawls, a beam trawl. And a beam trawl is imagine a trawl net that's attached to a rigid beam. So the width of the trawl is actually fixed by the width of the beam. And usually there's some heavy ground gear. It's a popular method for harvesting flatfish in Europe. And they have very heavy chains that run along the seabed. And it's very, very heavy gear.
And then there was one called a hydro trawl?
Hydraulic dredge, yes. So that's a dredge it's a heavy steel-like structure which is placed on the seabed, and it's connected to the boat via a long pipe, and there's high-pressure water pumped through the pipe, and just ahead of the mouth of the dredge, that high-pressure water, fluidizes the sediments, if you like, and they use it to harvest clams and other shellfish.
Maybe not surprising based on those descriptions, they found that the otter trawl has the least impact on the bottom and on ecosystems there. It scrapes about an inch off the seafloor on average and removes about 6% of the marine life. That sounds, in the grand scheme of things, fairly minimal, is it?
Well, certainly relative to these other fishing methods. And take the hydraulic dredge. I mean, it's actually trying to capture animals that are embedded in the sediment. So in order to harvest them, you have to penetrate the sediment and sieve them out of the sand and soft mud. The scallop dredges that they refer to, scallops are down on the seabed, and so you need very good bottom contact in order to harvest them. Otter trawls, on the other hand, you're targeting flatfish and other species such as cod and haddock and pollock and what have you. And so you don't necessarily need to be as hard down on the bottom as you are with these other gears. And so for that reason, and as the results show, the seabed impact is generally much less than these other gears.
This analysis also looked at the ability of ecosystems to recover after being trawled and found that on average, it takes between about 2 and 6.5 years. But most areas, it would seem, that are trawled once are probably going to be trawled more frequently than that. So do they ever really get a chance to recover?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know, there are certainly areas in the Gulf of Maine that get trawled repeatedly, you know, sometimes day after day, month after month, year after year. But the fact is that those areas are still producing fish. Otherwise, the fishermen wouldn't be there. So why are the fish in these areas that are being repeatedly trawled? And, you know, if the environment was no longer suitable to them, they would move off. So in some sense, there's a degree of sustainability associated with fishing areas over and over again if the fish are still there.
And do we understand how it's sustainable if these ecosystems are being so disrupted?
I think we have to be careful in the words that we use. And they're being impacted. I wouldn't like to use the word disrupted. You know, they're being impacted regularly and, you know, day after day, month after month. But they have for a very long period of time. You know, when trawl fishing first was introduced to the Gulf of Maine some 100-odd years ago, certainly there would have been substantial disruption to the seabed at that time. But we should also bear in mind that most trawling occurs in shallow waters that are in a very dynamic environment. And, you know, when a hurricane comes through the Gulf of Maine, there is no doubt significant disturbance to the seabed at that time. When we get our storms come through, there is no doubt significant disturbance to the seabed at those times as well. So, you know, putting into context, you know, trawling certainly does have an impact. Does it disrupt? Well, I think impact is the appropriate way to describe the impact, particularly in an area that's trawled over and over and over again.
There's no new data in this study per se. It's a meta-analysis of 70 already peer-reviewed and published studies. Are any of the findings coming out of it surprising?
Well, I haven't had a chance to really get into the article, given it only came out a couple of days ago. But you know, what I particularly like about the article is that it provides these figures with which we can think about the impacts of trawling. So it provides a perspective about trawling that's been missing. Now, it's very easy to make spurious claims about the impacts of trawling and talk about, you know, them doing no end of damage to the seabed. But here we have a study from these world authorities having a look at what's been done around the world and saying, hang on a minute, it's not what we think it is. That there are areas, particularly when using otter trawling, that the impact on the bottom is not as bad as we make out. And so it says that 6% of the biota is the term they use, or macrofauna, macroinvertebrates. So they're referring to sponges and corals and marine worms and things like that. And they're saying that only about 6% are removed from the substrate with each pass of the trawl. And so each time the trawl goes by, another 6% of the original amount is removed. So that's an important statement. It basically is saying that 94% of those invertebrates that are on the seabed are left untouched. Now, that's a glass half full type of perspective, but, you know, that's the perspective that's been missing from the dialogue about trawl impacts. And it's also really important to consider that the trawling is a food production system. You spoke about how trawling is responsible for about 25% of landed seafood globally. I mean, it's the most productive fishing method we have around the globe. It's tremendously important. We can't just stop trawling. We must have it. It's a food production system. And yes, it has some impact. And now we're getting a better idea of just what that impact is, rather than hearing spurious or emotive and unsubstantiated claims about trawl impacts.
Does having a study like this, having, as you said, some numbers for this debate, does that have potential ramifications for local fisheries? Is this something that fishery regulators could pick up and do something with?
At this stage, I'm not sure what you can do with it from a regulatory framework. And, you know, there are already... there's already a lot going on in the Gulf of Maine. I mean, there are vast areas of the Gulf of Maine that are closed off to bottom trawling. There's a lot of area out there that's closed off permanently. Some of it is closed off seasonally. And there are also some areas that are closed off to certain types of otter trawl. So we're already making big inroads in protecting large areas of the Gulf of Maine. And, you know, there are also some gear options which fishermen can use and are increasingly used to minimise their impact, such as semi-pelagic trawl doors. So instead of having this heavy steel door running over the seabed, spreading the trawl open, you can operate these doors 6, 8, 10, 12 inches off the seabed, sometimes even higher, and they're still opening the trawl, but they're not having the impact.
This study seems like potentially good news for New England, both from the perspective of fishermen who may want to be defending the use of trawls and from the perspective of ecosystem health. But the fact that otter trawls are the least impactful means that there are these other trawl types that have much stronger impacts on bottom ecosystems. And that's often what's being used in the rest of the world. So could this analysis have an impact, a regulatory impact, a societal impact elsewhere in the world?
Possibly. I mean, again, a lot of these areas where these more impactful gears are used are very dynamic environments in their own right. I mean, hydraulic dredging is done in shallow waters, often with sandy and soft mud substrates. And, you know, those areas maintain a reasonably high degree of productivity even when there is, you know, substantial dredge activity. You know, scallop dredges, there's scallop dredge activity going on in Gulf of Maine and southern New England and other parts of the world. And again, these areas are productive, have been productive, and if they're managed effectively, can continue to be productive. So, you know, providing we understand what the impacts of these gears are and can sort of manage the areas to ensure that, you know, maybe that we need to, you know, we close areas off and we modify gear at certain times, I think we can sort of accept these impacts are true, they're real, and that's the trade-off. That's the price, if you like, that you pay for harvesting scallops and harvesting groundfish and other animals that's caught with this gear. If there are other ways of doing it that were less impactful, then we would be using them. But the fact of the matter is, you know, these gears are highly tuned and efficient, and they're very good at harvesting the animals that we're after.
Are there possible ways that it could be fine-tuned even further? Are there efforts to try to minimize even further the bottom impacts of trawling? I mean, I know there have been efforts to reduce the impact of, say, scallop dredges on sea turtles. But are there ways to reduce the impact of these trawls on the bottom? Or is it, as you say, just completely inevitable that if you're going after something that lives on the bottom of the ocean, you're going to have to disturb the bottom of the ocean?
There are some modifications that can be employed, and you know, semi-pelagic doors, as I mentioned, is just one option, and modifying ground gear so that fewer parts of the ground gear are in contact with the bottom. Modifying the cutter bar or the teeth on the dredge so that they don't penetrate quite as deep. There are things that can be done, but again, sometimes the trade-off with these is that when you make these modifications, the catching efficiency of the gear may go down. So the challenge for us, of course, is to make these modifications to reduce habitat impact, but also ensure that we don't make the gear really inefficient, because nobody's going to use it, and that's not what we need to be doing. We need to be using efficient fishing gear so that you go out, you catch the fish within certain limits, and it's not a wasteful process as you go and harvest those fish.
Steve Ayres is a research scientist at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. He joined us from Portland via Skype. Steve, thanks so much.
Thanks very much. It was a pleasure.
We turn our attention now from fishing to farming. President Trump last week nominated Sam Clovis to be chief scientist for the USDA. Clovis is a former economics professor, a conservative talk radio host, and he was an advisor to the Trump campaign. But he is not a scientist, and that has drawn harsh criticism from professional organizations of scientists, notably including the Union of Concerned Scientists. Joining me now is Karen Perry Stillerman. She's a senior analyst for food and environment issues at the Union of Concerned Scientists. Karen, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. It's nice to be here.
All right. The Union of Concerned Scientists put out a statement very soon after news of the nomination broke, not only saying that it is an ill-advised nomination, but that it is illegal. What's the thinking there?
Well, that's right. We did. And we say it's illegal because the United States Code, that's the code of laws, says that this person, and the full title for Mr. Clovis would be Undersecretary for Research Economics and Research Education and Economics. And that person also wears the hat of Chief Scientist. And the law is very specific that the person that fills that role should be chosen from among distinguished scientists with specialized training or significant experience in agricultural research or education or economics. And he does not have that training.
Well, he is a former professor of economics. Couldn't one make an argument on that point?
His advanced degree is in public administration, and I gather that he did teach economics at Morningside College. We don't think that fits the bill.
How much and what kinds of research would Sam Clovis or whoever gets this job be overseeing as chief scientist at the USDA?
So it's really all of the research agencies within this very large federal department. So there's an economics research branch. There's an agricultural research branch. There is the branch that actually grants research dollars to at universities and other institutions to do agricultural and food research. And so he would be overseeing about $3 billion in annual research and education investment. That includes technical assistance to farmers. And we just think, you know, this is a very large portfolio of research on a variety of topics that are really important on a day-to-day basis to farmers and rural communities, but also to all of us who rely on a safe and nutritious food supply and clean drinking water. So issues ranging from childhood obesity to pesticide safety to soil health and ways that farmers can be more efficient and profitable, all of these things would come under Clovis's within his portfolio. And I guess the bottom line is we think that it requires someone with grounding in the scientific process and a real understanding of how science is done, how the results of scientific research should be applied to public policy.
Well, when you talk about research spanning everything from childhood obesity to soil science, that is an enormous range. What kinds of qualifications have former chief scientists at the USDA had to try to fit that bill?
Right, and that's a great question because obviously no one person is going to have degrees and specialized training in all of those areas. And
one would really hope not.
That's not expected. So the last chief scientist under President Obama was a nutrition scientist. The one before that under President George W. Bush was a weed scientist. So, you know, any of these disciplines is relevant, but as I said, I think it's most important that somebody be really grounded in the scientific process and able to really think about how science is done and what is needed in scientific research for good public policy.
Besides the fact that Sam Clovis is not a scientist, he's also drawn criticism for his views on climate change and climate science.
That's
so
right.
What are those views and what's controversial about it?
He has called climate science junk science. You know, he's been very, very clear in the media in the past few years that he is a climate skeptic or denier. So, you know, this is not unusual in the Trump administration, but it is a real problem, and particularly in the U.S. Department of Agriculture, it's a problem for America's farmers. You know, farmers really rely on a stable climate, and we're looking at you know, years ahead of us of increased floods and droughts and more severe floods and droughts. Those are the kinds of things that will affect farmers and their ability to make a living off the land in a big way. And so having someone responsible for the science and the technical assistance and education that farmers need in that kind of situation who doesn't believe in that science is a real problem.
I have read, though, that he does have the support of some farm organizations, you know, not clear whether it would be a majority or not. how likely is Sam Clovis to be confirmed to this position? Because this does have to be a Senate-confirmed position.
That's right. He will require Senate confirmation. And, you know, it's not entirely clear. But I think we are hearing a lot of opposition already, and he's just been nominated a few days ago. So I do think that the senators who will be responsible for confirming him, you know, starting with the Senate Agriculture Committee, but moving out to the full Senate, will be hearing from constituents, from scientists, from farmers who think that they should go back to the drawing board and pick someone who's really qualified for this job.
I want to play devil's advocate for a minute here. NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, actually went without a chief scientist for over a decade. So how critical is it that this position be filled at all, or that it be filled with the most highly qualified individual? If NOAA could go without a chief scientist for a decade, couldn't USDA muddle through, I guess?
I mean, I guess an agency can muddle through. It's certainly not ideal. At the USDA today, there is someone who is acting in the capacity of Undersecretary for Research, Education, and Economics. And, you know, that's okay for the short term, but it would be far less than ideal to have this position unfilled, and I think worse to have this position filled by someone who just doesn't have the training and experience to fill it.
So you think it would actually be worse to have Sam Clovis in office than to have the office unfilled?
I guess it's all bad.
If we look at the situation more broadly in the Trump administration right now, there are a lot of science advisory positions that are currently vacant. In early June, The Washington Post has actually been tracking this and analyzing this over time, and they put it at 85% of the Senate-confirmed positions relating to science in the Trump administration still haven't been filled. Many don't even have a nominee. And for that matter, there's still no one leading the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, the top kind of science research coordinator for the U.S. government and the top science advisor to the president. How unusual a situation is this?
It's quite unusual. That Washington Post analysis was excellent. And yes, it said only 7 of 46 top science posts had been nominated. You know, the president talks about people slowing down his job appointments, but he's not even nominating people to fill these really important posts. You know, I think it is incredibly important in a complex society like we have today that public policy decisions be made based on science and by people who really understand science or advised by people who really understand science. So this is a big problem that many of these posts are not filled.
Do you think we are seeing impacts on national policy at this point, or is it too soon to see the impacts of having all of these positions unfilled?
I mean, I think some of them it will take time to see the impacts. But certainly, for example, the president withdrew from the Paris Accord on climate change. You know, there've been lots written about that and what might have influenced him, but really nothing about the science. And as you say, without having a science advisor, having a climate skeptic at the US EPA, we can only assume that he got very bad advice or no advice on the science of climate change. And I think, you know, climate change is affecting us now, and we're at a point where we need to be acting now to protect future generations. And so I think we're already seeing impacts.
That's Karen Perry Stillerman. She's a senior analyst for food and environment issues at Union of Concerned Scientists. Karen, thanks so much.
Thank you.
I'm Heather Goldstone. Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.